Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 40, the podcast where we try to get under the hood of technology and photography and all the science that combines it all together to just geek out on all the specs, the numbers, the science that we can. And we could try to get stories that are a little bit off the beaten path, and I think we will deliver on that today for sure. And I'm very pleased to have with me a returning guest host is Joseph Lanashke, otherwise known as Photo Joseph. Joseph, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Don. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, you were on, I looked it up, you were on back in episode 10, so it's been 30 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and we're still here, so our numbers are growing.
What's the advantage of being in charge? No one can fire you.
Exactly, and if I miss a week, then there's no penalties, right? So this has been a fun podcast ever since the beginning, and I'm glad. Thank you to everybody that provides me with positive comments and feedback. It helps me find the energy to keep this going, and you know, I wouldn't do this if it was just for me. So thank you to everybody that listens. And Joseph, since the last time we've talked, what's new and exciting with you?
Ooh, well, keep on building up on the YouTube channel. That's been my big push for better part of the last year, really trying to make this thing something real and just getting there. It is definitely getting there. It's kind of nice. So youtube.com/photojoseph. We do a live show 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9:30 a.m. Pacific. And it's turning out really well. You know, we talk about basically anything, any topic that is photography or video or sometimes live streaming related is fair game. And that has been the big push. We do it. You know, we're always evolving the format. I'm trying to make the main show a little bit on the briefer side because I know people don't want to watch 30, 40, 50 minute long videos. So we try to keep it around 15 minutes or so and then break into a separate Q&A session, which has worked out really well. So if you haven't checked out the show in a while, please do come by and check it out again. I would love to have you as a sub.
I was on one episode a while ago and we ran really long.
That was a bit different because it's an interview segment. Those we do a little bit differently.
Right. And it was a lot of fun. And you know, the thing about doing it live is the audience engagement is really worthwhile because you know that people listening just like you are asking questions in real time. And yep. It doesn't feel like you're just watching a recording. And you can ask questions yourself.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, there's something else that you'll have to be a part of. So I've started another segment called Business of the Business. And it is a interview segment I've shot 3 of them. 2 of them are released right now, interviewing content creators, so photographers, filmmakers, YouTubers, anybody who's in the business of making content, about the business side of it, how they actually make money, how they're making a living doing what they do. And it's been really fascinating to get different people's approaches to what it is that they do, how they got where they are, because most of us didn't start off doing this. And it's been a fun segment to do. And those actually go behind the membership wall at photojoseph.com. So there's a couple of them up there now, but I'd love to get you on the show at some point.
Oh, that'd be great. I mean, I'm a man that wears many hats on the business side of things, as I think you'll find almost every photographer
exactly.
is. You don't just do one thing. And so I got some fun stories I can share with you there.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Shooting anything interesting lately?
You know, most of the shooting I've been doing is for the channel, stuff that I'm shooting to demonstrate a product or to show how something works or to demonstrate a technique or whatever that might be. I know a bit of client work here and there. I had a local wood shop that I photographed for an international woodworking magazine, one of these things, just some agency out of New York found me and had me shoot that. So things like that here and there, kind of always fun to do real world work, if you will, but it's pretty nice having control and doing exactly what you want for your own projects.
I know. And it's fun because I do a lot of work on spec just because I want to do it. And eventually I come across somebody that wants to license it or buy a print of it or whatever mm-hmm. it happens to be. And that kind of work is inspiring for me. Like I had the opportunity recently to go down to the New Jersey Institute of Technology. I was doing some workshops in Princeton and Newark, New Jersey is about an hour away. And one of the assistant professors there saw me on, I think it was Tony and Chelsea's TNC Live, mm-hmm. and said, hey, you know what? If you're coming down to Princeton, why don't you stop by if you've got the time? I have an industrial like laboratory CT scanner that I have access to. CT scanners use x-rays, and it's completely programmable. Why don't we just put some stuff in it and make some photos as a collaboration effort?
Wow.
And so I spent 2 hours playing with some really fancy x-ray equipment. And I just posted on all of my social media streams the first of a few photos that I'll be sharing taken of a flower in x-ray. I did some mushrooms as well. Entirely different. I mean, you can't go out and buy an x-ray machine even if you wanted to.
Right.
I mean, they are regulated. And even if you could, this machine costs most of what my house costs, I'm sure. So, no, but it was fun and enjoyable. And the commentary and the feedback has been great. I'm not the first person to, you know, use x-rays to image flowers before,
sure.
But it's still a very unique niche, and who knows what will come of that. I'd love to do some more experiments within that, that area. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the photo now. That is very cool. Nice.
Keeps me passionate about the stuff that I do.
Yeah, and, no doubt.
And the further I go off the beaten path is great. But I mean, like even today I was editing a photo that I had taken of a waterfall in Bulgaria when we were there on some recent travels. And it was taken just with the Lumix GX9 yep. and the, I think it was the 12 to 32 kit lens.
Okay.
Just unbelievably inexpensive lens, tiny, sure. but you know, that made a print or an image that I will be printing and I'll be bringing to my next art show because,
nice.
You know, it's not so much about the gear on one extreme or the other in terms of cost and size and usability, mm-hmm. But it's what you do with it, right?
Yep, absolutely. That is always the case. It's not what you got, it's how you use it.
And talking about expensive camera equipment, I think that leads into our first story, which is it was a Petapixel article that was titled "The First Video Ever Shot from an Asteroid Surface." But I think the bigger discussion here is that we have, I don't want to call them rovers. They look like little jumping tambourines. but they are mechanical devices that mankind has landed on a asteroid. And this is fascinating because photography always becomes an element in these stories, video or stills or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, you read the comments on a lot of these posts, whether it be Petapixel or you should never read comment section.
You really shouldn't. It's just a bad idea to begin with.
but a lot of people are complaining that why are these images so low quality? first of all, Joseph, what do you think about the photos that have been sent back so far?
Well, it's fascinating to see this. It's just incredible to see something that you know is shot from the surface of an asteroid. I mean, come on. That is just awesome to see in the first place. Doesn't matter how good or bad the image is, even what the photo is of, it's just the fact that we're taking pictures on the surface of an asteroid, traveling how many thousands of miles per hour. What is this thing? It's 174 million miles away from us, and it's sending photos home. I mean, come on. How could you love that?
And this is put on by Japan. They are the host country that created the satellite and the little rovers or whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually have this website, and I encourage everybody to go to this. It's Haya2Now, Haya, the number 2, now.jp, and to get it in English is /en.html. This website shows you in real time what these things are doing, or at least the orbiter that is transmitting information. It tells you exactly what it's connected to on Earth, all of the numbers, how much energy it's using. It's just, I look at this and I'm just fascinated that this is just publicly available in real time. And I'm looking at a little light that's blinking and I'm thinking it's sending us data right now.
Exactly.
It's connected to the Goldstone Deep Space Communications Complex.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
But at different times, it connects to the Yasuda Deep Space Center, the Yuchinura Space Center, the Canberra Deep Space Communication Center, Madrid Deep Space Communication Center, and more.
Yep.
I didn't know we had deep space communication centers around the world. I mean, this seems like we're out of Star Trek here.
It pretty much is. It pretty much is. No, it's phenomenal to see. It's, you know, the whole, like you said, Star Trek, this whole idea of exploring new worlds and all that, it's what we're doing. I mean, we just a tiny little robot that's out there floating around, bouncing around in space. We don't have people out there doing it yet, but, you know, we're getting closer.
And, you know, I like to, of course, geek out over the space stuff, but the images are low quality.
Sure.
And you have to take a few things into consideration. Number one, its ability to transmit data back is at 1 kilobyte a second. So not exactly a high bandwidth connection there. We're going back like in internet era, probably mid-80s or so when we had connections of about that speed.
But just think, if you were in the 80s and someone told you that we could have a internet connection to something that is millions of miles away, even at that speed, you'd be like, what?
Yeah, you'd think that you know, you're not from the future. You lost your mind and you need to be committed.
Totally.
So we also have to consider when these projects start, because the proposal for such a project, including all of the specifications for it, happen with approvals well before construction and design ever come into play. And those designs rarely change, those specifications. And so it might be on paper, the camera and everything is decided, a couple of years before the product, the rovers and all the technology is finalized. It could be five, 10 years. And then it takes years for it to get there.
Yes, so it does.
We're dealing with technology that is just out of necessity outdated. But more than that, it has to survive the rigors of space. This can't be like the latest and greatest the camera technology that was around at the time. It has to survive cosmic radiation and the most extreme temperatures you might be able to imagine. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at the cameras that are on the International Space Station, they have to rotate them out periodically because they get full of hot spots or dark spots. The sensors decay because of all of the radiation that those cameras are exposed to compared to cameras that are down here on Earth, where that radiation doesn't get through the atmosphere. I even remember hearing a story about, cameras and other equipment being shipped by sea rather than by air to prevent them from being degraded even by a small amount. Because you take your camera on an airplane, there's less atmosphere between you and those cosmic radiation. So from that perspective, you have to have very hardy equipment. And most of the time, I don't think that they've ever used a CMOS sensor on any of the satellites or rovers. It's all been the older tried and tested CCD technology. And if something goes wrong with that camera, it's not like you can just replace the sensor. You have to be able to resurrect it from death if like a line of pixels happens to disappear or it just fails. And you have to have like circuit level ability from 170 million miles away to bring that back up. And so that's probably the reason why these cameras aren't as robust and distinct as we might otherwise expect them to. But it's also the size. I mean, these little rovers are absolutely tiny. And, you know, the size of like a box of cereal or smaller than that. And so with all of the equipment to transmit information, to maneuver, they do these little jumpy things to move around. They're not on wheels. And then the camera just becomes the added accent onto that. And there's only so much room you have once everything else is said and done.
Yep, absolutely. And just to put some of this in context, what you're saying for anyone who hasn't read the article yet, it's the comments that are, as you said in the beginning, reading the comment section can be a bad idea. But there's comments in there, people talking about why is this such a bad quality image? Why is there so much fringing? Why isn't this better? We have better cameras than this in my iPhone today. And yeah, you're like you said, it goes back how many years from when it was first developed, first put into there, had to travel so far. It's pretty old tech. But also, I saw one of the comments talking about with the weight. Well, it's not like it's a big deal. The weight is very small, but there's not just one camera. There's, 7 different cameras being used on each one of these. As you said, it's a tiny little device. There's a lot more going in, and I think that some of the people who are making comments here aren't really giving it a fair shake.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't have 2 card slots. Sure, thank you for the funny joke. But
It's not full frame RAW. What?
Yeah, exactly. And other people were commenting on the flare on the lenses. Well, you have to understand where flare comes from, or actually, what we use to solve flare on our lenses today. We use coatings, optical coatings, and those coatings are based on the principles of thin film interference. Thin film interference coatings, they're designed around a specific wavelength of light, so the visible spectrum. And you can design lenses to have special coatings that remove flare from the infrared spectrum or the ultraviolet spectrum. There's all these special scientific coatings that can be designed to go into play. But what if these are full spectrum cameras? I mean, I don't know their specifics, but there's going to be some design choices as to whether or not they put on certain coatings and how that impacts the scientific results. These images are not being taken for their beauty. They're taken for science.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, no matter how you look at it, the fact that we're getting these images from that far away shot from the surface of an asteroid, that's just crazy. It's awesome.
And the fun part about this is I hope that these rovers outlast their lifetime, just like the Mars rovers have.
Sure.
I mean, they were supposed to last a couple of weeks and they went on for many, many years. wouldn't it be fun if, okay, they've done all of the possible research that they can on this planet. Do they become like some sort of like sports teams now? Like, do you try to like bump them up against each other? And just, I have no idea how much science there will be to uncover on this asteroid, but these look like they are pretty solid, hardy devices that will last for many years to come. So they'll explore every inch of it. And as Earthlings here just get to benefit and geek out over the results.
Maybe one day we'll get one of the pictures coming back. It'll be like that photo of the macaw that took a picture of himself. See some space alien's face. What is this thing? Holds it up in front of him, throws it away, walks away.
Well, who knows? But I'm enjoying the results so far. And yep. Kudos to Japan for making this happen. Again, speaking about cameras that we will probably never use ourselves, there was an interesting announcement at Photokina that didn't get a whole lot of press. But I think that from a societal and cultural standpoint, it can change the way that we consume certain media. And so this was Red, and they've teamed up with Facebook, which they've also teamed up with Facebook to create the Red Hydrogen smartphone, which is my new current working phone. And I
love it. Look at you. I didn't even know that. Wow. You got one of those things, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's the screen, if you see the screen and you'll see what I'm doing here, is quite big and beautiful. And these devices are a thing of beauty.
Wow.
So it is with, great excitement. I see that the partnership with Facebook is continuing. They're going to have the ability to have the H4V sort of 3D holographic images displayed on Facebook. If you have a compatible device, then Facebook is on board to dish out that content. But they've also teamed up with a 3D and 360 degree VR camera called Manifold. And this thing looks like it's a hovering ball of sentient technology about to wipe out the human race. But what it is 16 separate cameras, all with fisheye lenses in a sphere. And they've got some custom-made Schneider fisheye lenses. What gets me is I didn't think it was possible to do what they're doing. They have, behind each of those lenses, a Red Helium 8K sensor, shooting 8K at 60 frames per second, raw, times 16. I can't understand how much data that is actually creating and how
it can ever make
use of
it. I don't think the article doesn't tell us that, does it? I'd love to know how much data it actually is.
No, they don't say, and who knows exactly how much. It doesn't matter. It's way more data than we could ever possibly imagine. Before we get into possible use cases for this technology, Joseph, what do you think about the concept overall?
Well, so from a creative standpoint, from a filmmaker standpoint, a content creation standpoint, 360 has never been that interesting to me. And it's not because of quality. It's because as the viewer or as the director, I want to control where the viewer looks. I'm saying, look over here, not, I don't want to have to get their attention, say, hey, dummy, turn around. This is where the action is. So from that kind of Hollywood movie perspective, this type of thing doesn't really interest me. But
you'd have to be making content like a video game. And video games can be art and they have wonderful narratives.
Oh, sure.
They can also be just, you know, random shoot 'em ups and garbage in terms of a narrative.
That's going to be CG. Right? That's not going to be something, for the most part, that was filmed.
But you have the same lack of control over where people are looking and where they're going through the
right.
Through the content. And so I completely hear you. From a narrative perspective, it's much harder for this technology to be useful for somebody like you or me.
Right. But then you get into education or documentary purposes, and that's where it gets really interesting. To be able to explore, I don't know, the Mayan pyramids or something from inside and be able to move around them in as if you were in 3D space, you're in a VR type of simulation, and to have that resolution, that much detail to see something like that, that's pretty cool. To explore a live event like that. I think you had mentioned in the show notes something about like a political speech or any kind of a live event where there's people all on all sides, people all around you, to be able to document that at that level of resolution is pretty slick. And if you think about
historically, I mean, this is going to be really valuable, a presidential inauguration or a State of the Union address. I mean,
right, then we know how many people were actually there.
Let's not go there. But you would have the ability to get a front row seat. And it's not just a 360 view. It is with stereoscopic depth. They've got the parallax and everything nailed down. So it does become very, very immersive. What if you're a sports fan, right? And it's the Super Bowl. And what if you get like a front row seat to the Super Bowl, and all it is just one of these cameras in that seat?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they have one of those cameras like hovering right above the field in some way, shape, or form. And then you've got the best possible view of the game, and it's in stereoscopic 360 degrees. So I think for sporting events car races or the Olympics, could you imagine this at the Olympics? This could be a huge game changer for the way that this type of content is consumed.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very interesting. It really is. Like I said, it's historically, I haven't been that intrigued by it just because of the storytelling aspect, wanting to be able to control that narration. But from the documentary purposes, it does become a lot more interesting. And at this resolution, like you said, with the parallax effect, you do feel like you're more immersed. It is more like you are actually there. You're not just watching something projected onto a screen. That's where it starts to get really very, very interesting. So yeah, kudos to them. Excited to see where it goes.
The engineering cost on something like this must have been extreme. And they don't say how much something like this is going to cost.
Yeah, it's not listed there yet.
But if you have to ask, I don't think you can afford it. I think it's in that category. It would be really nice to see a device like this at the Olympic Games. I'm dead serious. You know, Tokyo 2020, something like this would be wonderful. I would buy an Oculus or a higher end, a VR headset in order to try and consume some of that stuff. If it's going to be delivered, and with a partnership with Facebook and the amount of money that Red is funneling into this, that they don't say if it's if the prototype that they were showing on display is functioning at full capacity, but they did provide some demo videos that look pretty well flawless. Interesting from a content consumption point of view, what the future holds for us.
Certainly. And I'm sure you'll be linking to this article in the show notes, but there are a couple of videos in here worth watching, sample videos from the camera.
Oh, check out these sample videos, because you can freeze at any point and they do a parallax sort of shift to show you. Yeah. You know, if you were viewing this with a 3D headset of any kind or, you know, on the Red Hydrogen smartphone, then you'd be able to see that level of depth, which is really exciting. And when they had announced the Hydrogen, they had said that Red will be working on high end 3D cinema cameras as well. And this is the first incarnation of that. I have no idea what else they might be working on, but suffice to say, they're becoming an industry leader in this, pulling out all the stops.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Nice. I don't think we can talk much more about that because it's not out yet, but
And I don't have one yet. You know, as soon as I get one, I'll let you know.
I'll get a couple of them and set them up around the house and let you know what I think. But
there you go.
Okay. So that was, from a technology point of view, groundbreaking, unbelievably expensive, and could possibly change the way that that we interact with certain events. The next one is a little bit lower key, and that is the Zeiss ZX-1, which is a full-frame compact camera that they announced also at Photokina. We didn't get a chance to talk about this next week, and last week. It's Zeiss's very first camera. It's about time that they step into this market. They've been making lenses for a very, very long time. Fixed lens, but I kind of started scratching my head at this. It has Adobe Lightroom CC built into it. I'll let you start and run with this, Joseph. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I like it a lot more than you do. I think this is a really neat idea. Don't think of it from the camera perspective of, oh, I've got my Nikon, Canon, Lumix, whatever camera, and oh, I've added Lightroom to that. Think of it more like your mobile phone, and we've just taken a mobile phone camera and put a full-frame sensor in there with a Zeiss lens on it. Then it becomes more interesting in the sense of, yeah, okay, it's not the size of a mobile phone. It's quite a big compact camera, but
it's kind of reminiscent of some of the Sigma Fovion cameras.
Sure.
And the kind of curve.
Yeah, it's got kind of a curious shape to it, but yeah, it's a full size camera. This is not something that you just slip into your pocket, but to be able to shoot and edit directly on the camera is something that we've all become accustomed with on our smartphones. It's something we all do every day. Super easy to do. But what if that picture could be so much better quality than what you're getting off of the smartphone? Why not? And if you have the ability to edit and share and post to Instagram or send to a client or whatever it is you're going to do from the device itself, why not? I've been excited about the possibility of this merger of technologies, if you will. And the closest thing that we really have right now is the ability to very easily get content from your camera, full-size camera, over to your smartphone or your iPad, whatever it might be. And this just removes that barrier. Now, there are some tech specs about it that are a little bit questionable, but from its basic core ideal that you have a really, really good camera that is a smartphone or a smartphone that has a really, really good camera on it, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, well, and it's got Wi-Fi built in so that you can automatically upload all of your stuff to the cloud and they say, or back it up to a NAS drive or share files to another computer. One might assume that updates could come to share directly to social media. They didn't mention that in this article, but that would be kind of filling that role that you are suggesting where it can automatically be sent off to the client. But, you know, the interface for editing on something like this. I don't use a lot of phone apps to edit photographs. I would much rather take that content using a mouse and keyboard or some sort of tablet interface, have greater control over how the images are produced. But I'm not the everyday average photographer in that regard.
The stuff that you do in Photoshop is way beyond what the majority of people are going to do. And I personally do a lot of work on mobile. I do a lot of image editing on mobile, whether it's on an iPad or on an iPhone, to be able to open an image in Lightroom. And I use Lightroom CC. I think it's great. And the amount of work that you can do to a picture on your phone is remarkable. And you have the same tools, exact same tools on the desktop, the iPad, or the phone. So it really is just about the size of the screen. And yeah, of course, it's a little bit easier to manipulate things when you got more real estate, but you can certainly do it.
And if this was, if you're a wedding shooter and this was a backup camera that you have, or sort of a second shooter device, you could easily take a couple of snaps of people around, do some quick edits. I assume you can apply presets and things like you would normally be able to do in Lightroom.
Sure.
And then automatically send that off to the bride and groom while you're shooting, or you know, when you're on a dinner break or something. And that sense of immediacy can be valuable for certain photographers. I totally get it. It seems to me like I've always had a separation between shooting and editing. I sit down in my studio with a 32-inch 4K display and I fine-tune all of the details and I dodge and I burn or whatever technique that you want to refer to. But that kind of control, I think, would be much more difficult or cumbersome on a smaller device like this. And when I say cumbersome, it might take me more time to do what I want. I might get the same results, but it's going to take me more time. And so time is valuable. I always want to make sure that that I'm spending it appropriately.
Sure. You could also think of it as you can start here and finish on the desktop, right? Because it is Lightroom CC, it's all synced to the cloud. So any photos that you take on your, even if you never touch them, even if you didn't do any editing at all on the device, on the camera, you sit down at your desk and there's all the photos already in Lightroom, already imported.
That's a good point.
If you want to do some basic culling, you want to do some selects, you want to just do some simple adjustments while you're on the road and then finish them when you get back. Now, also, I think you mentioned it as a wedding photographer's second camera. I don't really see it being used there, but imagine it as a travel camera. You're going on a trip, family vacation. You're not taking a million cameras and lenses with you. You just want something small and light. Not only do you have a great camera in your hands that you can actually edit and share from right there, every photo you take, every time you hit Wi-Fi, is automatically being backed up. That's pretty cool too.
The backup component is interesting. Although, I mean, that can be rolled into any camera if the manufacturers decide to add that feature without having the whole editing workflow built in. What I liked about this that I thought was really interesting is it's got 512 gigabytes of internal storage. And so it can use different media formats like SD, CFast, or XQD cards, or is it QXD?
No, it skips that. It doesn't do that. It just has the drive.
Oh, so I'm misreading that. So it just has the internal SSD. Now, I don't think I'd ever need more than 512 gigabytes in a device like this. I think that that is solid. But what I miss is this was way back. I had a point and shoot camera that had some internal storage in addition to a memory card. It was only like 16 megs of internal storage. So you'd be able to take maybe 8 pictures with that. But how often have you, you know, gone out to shoot and you forgot to put the memory card in the camera? You don't have your other one and you can't take any pictures anymore. You can't even take one. Right. If that has happened to you more than zero.
The Mavic Air added that in. So I had the Mavic, the DJI Spark, the little drone, and that did not have any internal storage. And then when I got the Air, it has, I think it's 8 gigs internal. And it's like, oh, thank goodness, because I have gone out and sent that thing up in the air or gotten ready to send it up in the air and realized that there is no SD card in there. It's happened more than once. So having that internal storage is definitely useful. And it'll copy off of this quickly. It's got a USB-C 3.1 port. So that's the fastest USB-C you've got right now. That will copy off of there very quickly if you need to do that. But again, as soon as you hit Wi-Fi, it's all going to upload. Ideally, you never have to plug the camera in except to charge it.
Well, exactly. And if like when I'm traveling in Europe or whatever, I get just a local SIM card into my phone. And it's just obscene how inexpensive data is in Eastern Europe. So I could presumably tether this to my phone and then have the ability to just automatically, while I'm driving from location to location, have the stuff uploaded to the cloud. Again, I don't know if I would use that, though. My creative process is different, but
sure,
there's a market for it, absolutely. And Zeiss is trying to corner that market with their very first camera. And so kudos to them.
My big complaints on it are really about the screen itself. It's quite a low resolution screen.
Yeah, it's only 1080p, right? It's
That's the viewfinder's 1080p. The LCD on the back's only 720p,
ooh,
which I compared it. It is basically like an iPhone 5S, the little one. The small previous form factor, that size and resolution screen. And that's a pretty small screen to be dealing with. So I'm not quite sure why they went so small on that. You'd think for everything else that went into it, you could put a slightly larger, higher resolution LCD on there and be better off. But no, according to this article, it is only 720p.
Yeah, I'm reading it as well. You know, I read this very poorly in preparation for this for this recording, but you're right, and that is a big drawback because a lot of LCD screens on the back of cameras now, I mean, they're pushing well beyond 1080p in terms of resolution now. So
well, sure, but it's not even about being able to see the picture with that higher resolution. Because you're putting Lightroom on here,
your user interface needs to be a full interface.
Yeah,
it doesn't want to be. I would not want it to be blocky and sort of hard to read and understand what I'm doing.
Right. So I like the idea of it. I think it's a winner of an idea. I think there's a few tech specs on it that need to be significantly improved. But I'd be excited to get my hands on a 2.0 version of this.
I think you're right. A 2.0 version, and Zeiss is a big company. If they have any amount of sales of this and get user feedback and can redesign some things in firmware, and then when the next hardware redesign comes, fix any of the flaws for a second version. Great, Zeiss. Good job. Okay, final story of the week here. This is one that both of us have read from Google Translate because the website that produces it, Le Numérique, is French. But they had an interview with the photo manager at Panasonic, and this is about the history and as much as that they can reveal about the partnership between Leica, Panasonic, and Sigma for the use of the L mount for upcoming cameras. And Yusiku Yamade is the guy, the photo manager who participated in this interview. And there were some really fun historic elements about this that came up. And we should say, of course, Joseph, you and I are both sponsored by Panasonic. And so, I mean, we definitely have a bias towards their equipment in the best possible ways. But when I was reading this to discover the path that they went down to arrive where they are today with the announcements that they made at Photokina. We talked about that in last week's episode. What little nuggets of knowledge here did you find most useful?
Well, it's interesting to see them talk about the duration of this project, how long it's been going on. And I think that a lot of people who One of the things that I've heard is clearly this is in response to, and just back up for a moment in case anybody's not quite sure what we're talking about, missed last week's show. We're talking about the full frame announcement from Panasonic Lumix. So there's a full frame, series of full frame cameras coming out next year. And I have seen, it's unbelievable to me personally, but I've seen people saying that this is in response to Canon and Nikon releasing full frame cameras. And you think, how long do you think it takes to develop something like this? It's not like, I mean, those announcements just came out, what, a month to 2 months ago. It's not like they went, oh, that's a good idea, we should do this too, and then immediately sat down and produced a camera with a working prototype. And like, come on, it's been years that they've been doing this.
Well, yeah, and then, they're stating that it's going to be out in 2019. Mm-hmm. There's no secret there. But you can't just announce it at Photokina because there's rumors of your competitors coming out with something and have it ready to market in a few months. I mean, they said very specifically that they started looking at the possibilities 8 years ago. Right. And that doesn't mean that they started, you know, designing anything 8 years ago, but they were evaluating the market and seeing exactly what the possibilities would be. Now, that's 2 years after they launched the very first G-series camera, the G1, because they just also announced their 10-year anniversary with the Micro Four Thirds format. So they were 2 years into Micro Four Thirds when they started exploring what the potential of a full-frame product might be. And you know, at the time, clearly either the tech or I don't want to put words in their mouth, but it's been a long road to get here from there.
Sure.
And so the partnership was also with Sigma and with Leica came much later in the development. I mean, I'm assuming, maybe I shouldn't do a whole lot of assuming here, but that they had a viable product, and Sigma had announced something that they were doing some research in one of their interviews as well about producing a mirrorless full frame format with a shorter flange distance because their SA mount was getting quite dated. And they were toying with the idea when Panasonic approached them to make this partnership, and they all agreed, hey, you know, let's just go under the same banner here under the L mounts. And that, you know, synergistic relationship is going to help them flourish, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm personally very excited to see what comes out of it. You know, we've obviously talked about it on my show as well at length. And for me personally, I don't see myself switching over to full frame because I switched away from full frame because I like Micro Four Thirds. I like the smaller form factor. But obviously, there will be a place for it in many, many camera bags. And if I do end up having my hands on one, I'm sure it's something that I'll use in the studio when I'm not going out carrying gear around. But you know, I like Micro Four Thirds. There's a reason that I went for it. But I'm very glad to see Panasonic doing this. You know, one of the things as an ambassador, one of the things that we hear all the time is, when is Panasonic coming out with full frame? Where's the full frame? And even people who aren't asking it out of jest, but just genuinely don't know, they just know that full frame is quote unquote the best because that's what they've heard from everybody. Oh, you have to have full frame.
It's fuller, right?
It's just fuller, right? It's more full. They'll walk up to you at a store or at an event where you're doing something for Panasonic and say, what do you have that's full frame? And when you have to say, well, nothing, we don't do full frame, they would just walk away. They go, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go check out the Sony full frame. And they're not buying Sony full frame or Canon full frame. They walk up, they see the Sony, Canon, Nikon full frame prices, choke. Once they've recovered from their near heart attack, they end up putting money down on an APS-C camera. So I'm excited just for the halo effect of people coming into the brand because, ooh, they do full frame. They're probably not going to buy full frame. It's obviously going to be more expensive and bigger than the Micro Four Thirds, but it'll bring them into the brand and maybe they'll fall in love with Micro Four Thirds.
Yeah, they're entirely different markets. I mean, the reason why I love the Micro Four Thirds cameras is because when I travel, and I'm traveling more and more, I don't have to carry a 1D, like a Canon 1D series body around with me because that was massive and breaking my back. I remember hiking up a mountain in the Yukon with a bunch of that gear with me. And it was exhausting.
Sure.
And when I shot with the 100 to 400 Leica Lumix lens recently, I was doing the most beautiful sunrise and sunset photographs with something that was a fraction of the weight. And so it is incredibly useful. And for macro photography, which is sort of in my wheelhouse as well, the smaller sensor at 1:1 magnification gives me that perceived magnification increase. And so a good macro lens does not need extension tubes for most subjects. So there's a lot more value in that format. However, higher megapixels, of course, you know, 47 on the high end and 24 on the low, but 47 megapixels, some photographers need that. And that's going to be of value for those people. It's the reason why some people need that full frame performance. And if you are shooting in almost zero light, the more surface area that a sensor has, the more light that it can collect. And and you're winning in that scenario as well. But if we talk again about this road that Panasonic has been down, you know, starting about 8 years ago, they mentioned in one of their press releases or in one of their slides at the press conference that they are going to be ready in 2020 for the Tokyo Olympic Games with an 8K capable device. So we have the two announced products that will be out in 2019, but they are like, they're not stopping there and testing the waters and seeing, okay, well, are you going to like this? Or are we going to, you know, stay in this market? They've got the next round also in development, and they've only said 8K. There's no statistics that we have beyond that. But he does say in the article, you know, and this is translated from French, but it's not easy to produce 8K images. and we're already studying how 8K images will be used to determine the customer needs in this area. So that's continuing to go on. One little Easter egg in this article that I had no idea about was they were asked if Panasonic was going to make a follow-up to their CM1 smartphone. And I just cocked my head to the side a little bit as I was reading that. And I said, I had no idea that there was a Lumix branded smartphone. I know Panasonic has made some for other markets, but not under the Lumix brand. And I looked it up. It actually looks pretty cool. I'm sorry, I never knew about it before.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty cool little camera. So it was basically going back to the Zeiss story. It was a, not as big and good as the Zeiss is, but it was a larger sensor, good quality lens camera built into a smartphone. So you had what was effectively an Android phone that was just a quite a bit thicker and heavier than your average smartphone, but it had this really great camera on it. As far as I know, I don't think it was ever available in North America. I'm pretty sure it was only a Europe and Asia market thing. And I guess it didn't do very well, or else they would have continued to make them.
I guess so. But you know, I tried to find one on eBay, and they are ridiculously priced above MSRP.
Really?
Maybe they're a collector's item now or something, but it was like $1,600 bucks. So I wanted to get my hand on one, but not at that price, just to see what it was all about. But anyhow, Panasonic into some wonderful new markets, and the lenses that they've announced, and the lenses that, of course, Sigma are bringing to the table. And if you've got the cash for the Leica lenses, it's going to be a system that hits the ground running in a really good way. So I'm eager to get my hands on one. Don't know exactly when that'll be, but you'll get a full report whenever that happens. Perfect. Well, that winds down the stories. And again, all of these links will be in the show notes for everybody to check out and make their own decisions and comment on. I appreciate when people leave comments on the website as well. So if you enjoyed the stories, you've got a different opinion from us, please let that opinion be known and start a conversation about it. We always enjoy that. And if you are listening via iTunes or any other place where you can leave a review of the podcast, please do, especially if you like us, because that will help with discoverability and people will enjoy, discovering this podcast and help our audience grow. So the final section of the podcast, as always, is a pick of the week section. And Joseph, I think I know what you're going to pick. Why don't you confirm my suspicions here?
Yeah, sure thing. So I just got my hands on this fun little new lens from a company called Lens Baby, and it's the Sol 22, and that's for 22 millimeter. And it is if you've ever used the original Lens Baby, going back to the very first one, you might recall that it was essentially two pieces of glass with a stretchy rubberized bellows in between them. And as you pushed and pulled the lens forward and backward and tilted it off axis, you changed the focus point and both its focus distance and the focus position. It moved around the screen. You could put it in the center or the top right corner, wherever you wanted. And they evolved that over time, and they gave you tools to lock it into place so it wasn't quite so organic and just kind of a random. And this one is a very controllable version of that lens with a separate focus control. So you have one knob to position it in 3D space, if you will, and another one to focus it. And it's fun. It's only $200, and that's that same price whether you're buying it for Micro Four Thirds or for Canon, Nikon, anything else. And it becomes a 44 or 45 millimeter on full frame. And It's just a fun little lens for $200. I really enjoyed it. So I just got my hands on this recently. I did a video on it actually on the show. So if you go to youtube.com/photojoseph and scroll down a little bit or just search for Lens Baby, you'll find the video on it. But in that video, I had shot some photos and some video that I put together into a little couple minute long montage that's part of the live show. So it's fun. I enjoy having things like this that are unique, that are clever, that are different, and especially that are cheap, like cheap.
Well, and you know, photography, I've spent a lot of money on lenses to get pixel perfect representation of the subject that I am photographing. Right. I've also spent, you know, $40 on weird Soviet lenses that I take apart and put back together in a different way because it just messes with light in a way that is not perfect, but is artistic. And so lenses like the Lens Baby Soul have the ability to, you know, force artistry into the mix by,
there you go.
I don't want to say just taking away quality because it's quality is subjective.
Yeah, it's not.
It's not that it's trying to degrade things. It's trying to change things, to change the way that light is interpreted. If I remember correctly, that lens had two apertures or it had some stuff that you could kind of put in front of it and manipulate.
So there's a separate lens that has dual apertures. This one has blades that
go
in
front
of the lens that you can open and close and rotate as well. And it really, it has a very interesting effect on the bokeh. So one of the sample photos that's, again, it's in that video on my YouTube channel, I was photographing, I don't know what they're called, the cattails, I think that's what you call them. Mm-hmm. Not on a cat, but the plant, those kind of, you know what I mean. And you know, that's just a lot of vertical lines. And the bokeh with the vertical line bokeh really emphasized that, and it made for this really cool streaky looking background that worked in both photo and video. So it's just a clever, fun little effect.
And you mentioned video, and this is something that a lot of people don't think of specifically. That kind of effect in post-processing on video is nigh impossible, at least to the same level of degree. I remember there was a lens that I had it was a Soviet era lens. It was taken apart and put back together with no coatings on it. And you could, when ordering them, you could ask for like grime and grit to be left on the lens elements to muck with the image quality. And without the lens coatings, as we were mentioning earlier on about those coatings and thin film interference and how they stop flare and everything, you would get much more realistic and dramatic flare for video purposes, because it's so hard to do that well in post. It's not impossible, but if you can get that in camera, if you can get the artistic intent and, you know, you want to do like a dream sequence or something for video, you know, put one of these lenses on your camera and it won't look quite like reality, but maybe the way somebody remembered it to be. I'm not sure, but the possibilities are there for both stills and video.
They are.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun.
Awesome. And my pick is something that I use on a regular basis. I clean my own camera sensors, and you know, when I was looking for the proper, you know, tech to do wet cleaning, there's a lot of companies that offer them, and I was kind of scared at first, as one would be when you're putting liquid inside of your camera. But I settled eventually on products from a company called Visible Dust. And Visible Dust, they make all sorts of things from special bulb blowers and sensor loops so that you can get a magnified view of the sensor to see if there is any dust and everything on that. Mm. And I've got their whole suite of products. I have found that in the past, my cameras, they have two types of swabs, a green swab and an orange one. The green ones worked really well for older cameras, and now I'm finding that the orange ones work for whatever glass is in front of the sensors to get an even cleaner result. So my pick of the week is the Visible Dust orange swabs, the DHAP swabs, with the V-Dust Plus, which it's an alcohol-based cleaning solution. So these two things, plus some of their other accoutrements, if you want to get into cleaning your own camera sensors, it's not that expensive compared to the price that you're going to pay even the manufacturer to clean it, or you bring it into a camera store or somebody else. It's going to be about $50. But if you do it yourself, then you're immediately saving money. You can do it whenever you need to without losing your camera for a week or two in the process. And it's scarier in concept than it is in practice. For the hundreds, if not maybe 1,000 times, maybe I'm not quite there yet, that I've cleaned camera sensors for myself or other members of my local community here, I've never once even remotely broken anything. So
I think it's worth pointing out too, the big fear that people have of doing this is that they're going to scratch their sensor. Rightfully so. Understandable fear to have. But it's also worth recognizing that it's not the sensor. You're not touching the sensor. You're touching a layer of glass on top of the sensor, which is a lot stronger than the sensor itself.
That layer
so,
of glass?
Yeah, so while you certainly can scratch it.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. With care, as long as you follow the directions, make sure you're being careful about it. You shouldn't have any problems at all.
I had one guy came to my door in desperation. He had a unbelievably dirty sensor, like you leave it open on the beach on a windy day kind of thing. And then he got a used swab from somebody else and tried to clean his camera sensor dry with a used swab. And he brought it to me in that condition. And so, I mean, it took a lot of effort. I did get it, you know, cleaned up and spotless. And there were some scratches on the sensor from his attempt. He wasn't able to see, and in my tests, I couldn't see any impact from those scratches in the resulting images. And if he wanted to, you can always go to the manufacturer or anybody that does conversions of cameras to infrared photography. They can replace that glass with an identical piece of glass that blocks infrared and ultraviolet light. That's one of the purposes of it. And so you can get your camera back into working condition for a couple of $100, slap on the wrist. But I've never seen anybody have to do that if they, you know, did proper practice. You only ever use one swab once. Don't ever reuse it. But on my traditional SLR cameras, I would clean the sensor with one swab, and then I might clean the reflex mirror with the same swab afterwards, because that's just dust on the mirror, and I'm not worried about that so much. I just don't want that dust to flap around and end up in the camera sensor itself.
And with these flat cleaning tools that you're talking about, I've seen these before, and like you said, you only use it once, but you can use both sides of it, right? So you can swipe one direction, then you flip the flip the cleaner over, the swab over, and go the other way, or is that not how they?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you can. I typically don't, but I'm sure you wouldn't encounter much harm if you did that, unless the camera was excessively dirty when you bring the swab across at once and then take that swab out and never let it touch the camera again. They sell them in packs of 12, packs of 50, actually. And I buy the 50 packs because the cost per swab gets much lower. If you are going to be cleaning your camera sensor now, you're going to be cleaning your camera sensor forever. And you don't want to run out of those particular swabs. And when you buy the 50 pack, they come with this little swab holder that has a little light on it. And it'll help you illuminate the inside of the camera sensor while you're actually swabbing.
Oh, that's cool.
Around. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And then do you get them in different sizes? So you have one that you only have to swipe across the sensor once to cover the whole thing?
You know, I get the full frame ones that I don't know if I'm supposed to, but they work perfectly fine on APS-C sensors as well. Full frame, you swipe across horizontally. The APS-C sensors, I swipe vertically, and it seems to work just fine based on the physical size of the sensors. And they make some smaller ones for Micro Four Thirds and so on. So you just get the size that you are after. I don't know if they have the 50 packs for the Micro Four Thirds. Maybe if you ask them, they've got something. It just wasn't listed on their website.
Sure.
Yeah, and good Canadian company that I like to support.
Oh, good.
There, so.
Excellent.
So that was my pick. And if anybody has any questions about, you know, cleaning sensors and what have you, it could be a topic that we always revisit. Always send your questions to us. You can find the link to contact me at photogeekweekly.com. I said this was the final segment, but really we lead out by me asking what you're going to be shooting next. What's the next big, concept or idea that you're going to be exploring? Joseph.
Ooh, gosh, next big thing that I'm going to be, I don't know, because I'm so wrapped up right now in interviews and prepping for various events that I'm teaching at or shooting at. But it's not like I don't have any big personal project or big thing that I'm going to shoot. But because I don't, I'm going to completely hijack your question and be a politician and turn it. I'm going to give you the answer that I want to give you, which is where people can find me next. Because I am doing some events that are publicly accessible. So I'm going to be doing a thing at Hunt's Camera in Boston, not next week, but the week after. And that is all of these things I'm going to mention are on my website, photojoseph.com/events. You can find them there, find out where to sign up and register for them. So if you're in the Boston area, this is a free seminar that you can go to. The following week, I'll be in New York for Photo Plus Expo, leading a photo walk for Panasonic on Friday evening. That is also free to sign up for. Those seats are already half gone, and I just posted on my Facebook page and haven't promoted it all yet. So again, photojoseph.com/events. And then in the beginning of next year, I'm going to India. I know we've talked about that before.
Oh, yeah. Have you sold that one out yet?
We have. We finally got the fourth seat sold. It's been unbelievably hard work to get this moving, but it's a unique trip. It's certainly not for everybody. I thought it might be for a few more people than it has been, but we got number four. So it's four is the minimum, but there are still four seats available. So if you are interested in going to India, just go to photojoseph.com/India. You can learn all about the workshop there. It's going to be incredible. And it's going to be a really once in a lifetime experience.
Awesome. That's great. Say hi to Gary for me, by the way, when you're at Hunt's.
Oh, absolutely.
on that same note too, I'm traveling tomorrow. I'm hopping on a plane and going out to Calgary, Alberta to the Camera Store, where I will be recording an episode of DP Review TV with the guys out there.
Oh, fun.
And doing a presentation, a 90-minute presentation, which should be a lot of fun as well. And hanging out at the store for a meet and greet too. So if you are in the Calgary area or you can find yourself there with relative ease, stop by and see me in the next couple of days. So that'll be fun. All right. Well, that about ends the episode. We are just under the hour mark where I like to be. So, Joseph, thank you again for being here. I'd love to have you back on more frequently. We always have such a great conversation. And you geek out like the best of them. It's always fun to hear your opinions on these things. So thank you. And you can find the links to all of Joseph's stuff on Photo Geek Weekly, as well as his youtube.com/PhotoJoseph. So with that said, it's time to get out and shoot.